Side 12, Dagon and Other Macabre Tales by H.P. Lovecraft. Continuing with The Alchemist on page 334. He told how the young Charles had escaped into the night, returning in after years to kill Godfrey the heir with an arrow just as he approached the age which had been his father's at his assassination. How he had secretly returned to the estate and established himself unknown in the even then deserted subterranean chamber, whose doorway now framed the hideous narrator. How he had seized Robert, son of Godfrey, in a field, forced poison down his throat, and left him to die at the age of 32, thus maintaining the foul provisions of his vengeful curse. At this point, I was left to imagine the solution of the greatest mystery of all. How the curse had been fulfilled since that time, when Charles Le Sorcier must, in the course of nature, have died. For the man digressed into an account of the deep alchemical studies of the two wizards, father and son, speaking most particularly of the researches of Charles Le Sorcier concerning the elixir which should grant to him who partook of it eternal life and youth. His enthusiasm had seemed for the moment to remove from his terrible eyes the hatred that had at first so haunted them. But suddenly the fiendish glare returned, and with a shocking sound like the hissing of a serpent, the stranger raised a glass phial with the evident intent of ending my life, as had Charles Le Sorcier 600 years before ended that of my ancestor. Prompted by some preserving instinct of self-defense, I broke through the spell that had hitherto held me immovable, and flung my now dying torch at the creature who menaced my existence. I heard the phial break harmlessly against the stones of the passage, as the tunic of the strange man caught fire and lit the horrid scene with a ghastly radiance. The shriek of fright and impotent malice emitted by the would-be assassin proved too much for my already shaken nerves, and I fell prone upon the slimy floor in a total faint. When at last my senses returned, all was frightfully dark, and my mind, remembering what had occurred, shrank from the idea of beholding more. Yet curiosity overmastered all. Who, I asked myself, was this man of evil, and how came he within the castle walls? Why should he seek to avenge the death of poor Michel Mauvais? And how had the curse been carried on through all the long centuries since the time of Charles Le Sorcier? The dread of years was lifted from my shoulders, for I knew that he whom I had felled was the source of all my danger from the curse. And now that I was free, I burned with the desire to learn more of the sinister thing which had haunted my line for centuries, and made of my own youth one long-continued nightmare. Determined upon further exploration, I felt in my pockets for flint and steel, and lit the unused torch which I had with me. First of all, the new light revealed the distorted and blackened form of the mysterious stranger. The hideous eyes were now closed. Disliking the sight, I turned away and entered the chamber beyond the Gothic door. Here I found what seemed much like an alchemist's laboratory. In one corner was an immense pile of a shining yellow metal that sparkled gorgeously in the light of the torch. It may have been gold, but I did not pause to examine it, for I was strangely affected by that which I had undergone. At the farther end of the apartment was an opening leading out into one of the many wild ravines of the dark hillside forest. Filled with wonder, yet now realizing how the man had obtained access to the chateau, I proceeded to return. I had intended to pass by the remains of the stranger with averted face, but as I approached the body, I seemed to hear, emanating from it, a faint sound, as though life were not yet wholly extinct. Aghast, I turned to examine the charred and shriveled figure on the floor. Then, all at once, the horrible eyes, blacker even than the seared face in which they were set, opened wide with an expression which I was unable to interpret. The cracked lips tried to frame words which I could not well understand. Once I caught the name of Charles Le Sorcier, and again I fancied that the words years and curse issued from the twisted mouth. Still, I was at a loss to gather the purport of his disconnected speech. At my evident ignorance of his meaning, the pitchy eyes once more flashed malevolently at me, until, helpless as I saw my opponent to be, I trembled as I watched him. Suddenly, the wretch, animated with his last burst of strength, raised his hideous head from the damp and sunken pavement. Then, as I remained paralyzed with fear, he found his voice, and in his dying breath screamed forth those words which have ever afterward haunted my days and my nights. "Fool," he shrieked, "can you not guess my secret? Have you no brain whereby you may recognize the will which has through 6 long centuries fulfilled the dreadful curse upon your house? Have I not told you of the great elixir of eternal life? Know you not how the secret of alchemy was solved? I tell you, it is I, that have lived for 600 years to maintain my revenge, for I am Charles Le Sorcier." The Transition of Juan Romero. Of the events which took place at the Norton Mine on October 18th and 19th, 1894, I have no desire to speak. A sense of duty to science is all that impels me to recall in these last years of my life scenes and happenings fraught with a terror doubly acute, because I cannot wholly define it. But I believe that before I die, I should tell what I know of the, shall I say, transition of Juan Romero. My name and origin need not be related to posterity. In fact, I fancy it is better that they should not be, for when a man suddenly migrates to the States or the colonies, he leaves his past behind him. Besides, what I once was is not in the least relevant to my narrative, save perhaps the fact that during my service in India, I was more at home amongst white-bearded native teachers than amongst my brother officers. I had delved not a little into odd Eastern lore when overtaken by the calamities which brought about my new life in America's vast West, a life wherein I found it well to accept a name, my present one, which is very common and carries no meaning. In the summer and autumn of 1894, I dwelt in the drear expanses of the Cactus Mountains, employed as a common laborer at the celebrated Norton Mine, whose discovery by an aged prospector some years before had turned the surrounding region from a nearly unpeopled waste to a seething cauldron of sordid life. A cavern of gold, lying deep below a mountain lake, had enriched its venerable finder beyond his wildest dreams, and now formed the seat of extensive tunneling operations on the part of the corporation to which it had finally been sold. Additional grottos had been found, and the yield of yellow metal was exceedingly great, so that a mighty and heterogeneous army of miners toiled day and night in the numerous passages and rock hollows. The superintendent, a Mr. Arthur, often discussed the singularity of the local geological formations, speculating on the probable extent of the chain of caves, and estimating the future of the titanic mining enterprise. He considered the auriferous cavities the result of the action of water, and believed the last of them would soon be opened. It was not long after my arrival and employment that Juan Romero came to the Norton Mine. One of a large herd of unkempt Mexicans, attracted thither from the neighboring country, he at first commanded attention only because of his features, which, though plainly of the Red Indian type, were yet remarkable for their light color and refined conformation, being vastly unlike those of the average greaser or Paiute of the locality. It is curious that although he differed so widely from the mass of Hispanicized and tribal Indians, Romero gave not the least impression of Caucasian blood. It was not the Castilian conquistador or the American pioneer, but the ancient and noble Aztec, whom imagination called to view when the silent peon would rise in the early morning and gaze in fascination at the sun as it crept above the eastern hills, meanwhile stretching out his arms to the orb as if in the performance of some rite whose nature he did not himself comprehend. But save for his face, Romero was not in any way suggestive of nobility. Ignorant and dirty, he was at home amongst the other brown-skinned Mexicans, having come, so I was afterward told, from the very lowest sort of surroundings. He had been found as a child in a crude mountain hut, the only survivor of an epidemic which had stalked lethally by. Near the hut, close to a rather unusual rock fissure, had lain two skeletons, newly picked by vultures, and presumably forming the sole remains of his parents. No one recalled their identity, and they were soon forgotten by the many. Indeed, the crumbling of the adobe hut and the closing of the rock fissure by a subsequent avalanche had helped to efface even the scene from recollection. Reared by a Mexican cattle thief who had given him his name, Juan differed little from his fellows. The attachment which Romero manifested toward me was undoubtedly commenced through the quaint and ancient Hindu ring which I wore when not engaged in active labor. Of its nature and manner of coming into my possession, I cannot speak. It was my last link with a chapter of life forever closed, and I valued it highly. Soon I observed that the odd-looking Mexican was likewise interested, eyeing it with an expression that banished all suspicion of mere covetousness. Its hoary hieroglyphs seemed to stir some faint recollection in his untutored but active mind, though he could not possibly have beheld their like before. Within a few weeks after his advent, Romero was like a faithful servant to me, this notwithstanding the fact that I was myself but an ordinary miner. Our conversation was necessarily limited. He knew but a few words of English, while I found my Oxonian Spanish was something quite different from the patois of the peon of New Spain. The event which I am about to relate was unheralded by long premonitions. Though the man Romero had interested me, and though my ring had affected him peculiarly, I think that neither of us had any expectation of what was to follow when the great blast was set off. Geological considerations had dictated an extension of the mine directly downward from the deepest part of the subterranean area, and the belief of the superintendent that only solid rock would be encountered had led to the placing of a prodigious charge of dynamite. With this work, Romero and I were not connected, wherefore our first knowledge of extraordinary conditions came from others. The charge, heavier perhaps than had been estimated, had seemed to shake the entire mountain. Windows in shanties on the slope outside were shattered by the shock, whilst miners throughout the nearer passages were knocked from their feet. Jewel Lake, which lay above the scene of action, heaved as in a tempest. Upon investigation, it was seen that a new abyss yawned indefinitely below the seat of the blast, an abyss so monstrous that no handy line might fathom it, nor any lamp illuminate it. Baffled, the excavators sought a conference with the superintendent, who ordered great lengths of rope to be taken to the pit and spliced and lowered without cessation till a bottom might be discovered. Soon afterward, the pale-faced workmen apprised the superintendent of their failure. Firmly, though respectfully, they signified their refusal to revisit the chasm, or indeed to work further in the mine until it might be sealed. Something beyond their experience was evidently confronting them, for, so far as they could ascertain, the void below was infinite. The superintendent did not reproach them. Instead, he pondered deeply, and made many plans for the following day. The night shift did not go on that evening. At 2 in the morning, a lone coyote on the mountain began to howl dismally. From somewhere within the works, a dog barked in answer, either to the coyote or to something else. A storm was gathering around the peaks of the range, and weirdly shaped clouds scudded horribly across the blurred patch of celestial light which marked the gibbous moon's attempts to shine through many layers of cirrostratus vapors. Author's note. Here is a lesson in scientific accuracy for fiction writers. I have just looked up the moon's phases for October 1894 to find when a gibbous moon was visible at 2 a.m. and have changed the dates to fit. End of author's note. It was Romero's voice coming from the bunk above that awakened me, a voice excited and tense with some vague expectation I could not understand.
Madre de Dios! El sonido! Ese sonido! Oiga usted! ¿Lo oye usted? Señor! That sound!
I listened, wondering what sound he meant. The coyote, the dog, the storm, all were audible, the last named now gaining ascendancy as the wind shrieked more and more frantically. Flashes of lightning were visible through the bunkhouse window. I questioned the nervous Mexican, repeating the sounds I had heard.
El coyote? El perro? El viento?
But Romero did not reply. Then he commenced whispering as in awe.
El ritmo, señor. El ritmo de la tierra. That throb down in the ground.
And now I also heard and shivered, and without knowing why. Deep, deep below me was a sound, a rhythm, just as the peon had said, which, though exceedingly faint, yet dominated even the dog, the coyote, and the increasing tempest. To seek to describe it were useless, for it was such that no description is possible. Perhaps it was like the pulsing of the engines far down in a great liner, as sensed from the deck. Yet it was not so mechanical, not so devoid of the element of life and consciousness. Of all its qualities, remoteness in the earth most impressed me. To my mind rushed fragments of a passage in Joseph Glanvill, which Poe has quoted with tremendous effect. The vastness, profundity, and unsearchableness of his works, which have a depth in them greater than the well of Democritus. Footnote. Motto of A Descent into the Maelstrom. End of footnote. Suddenly, Romero leaped from his bunk, pausing before me to gaze at the strange ring on my hand, which glistened queerly in every flash of lightning, and then staring intently in the direction of the mine shaft. I also rose, and both stood motionless for a time, straining our ears as the uncanny rhythm seemed more and more to take on a vital quality. Then, without apparent volition, we began to move toward the door, whose rattling in the gale held a comforting suggestion of earthly reality. The chanting in the depths, for such the sound now seemed to be, grew in volume and distinctness, and we felt irresistibly urged out into the storm and thence to the gaping blackness of the shaft. We encountered no living creature, for the men of the night shift had been released from duty, and were doubtless at the Dry Gulch settlement, pouring sinister rumors into the ear of some drowsy bartender. From the watchman's cabin, however, gleamed a small square of yellow light, like a guardian eye. I dimly wondered how the rhythmic sound had affected the watchman. But Romero was moving more swiftly now, and I followed without pausing. As we descended the shaft, the sound beneath grew definitely composite. It struck me as horribly like a sort of oriental ceremony, with beating of drums and chanting of many voices. I have, as you are aware, been much in India. Romero and I moved without material hesitancy through drifts and down ladders, ever toward the thing that allured us, yet ever with a pitifully helpless fear and reluctance. At one time, I fancied I had gone mad. This was when, on wondering how our way was lighted in the absence of lamp or candle, I realized that the ancient ring on my finger was glowing with eerie radiance, diffusing a pallid luster through the damp, heavy air around. It was without warning that Romero, after clambering down one of the many rude ladders, broke into a run and left me alone. Some new and wild note in the drumming and chanting, perceptible but slightly to me, had acted on him in startling fashion, and with a wild outcry, he forged ahead unguided in the cavern's gloom. I heard his repeated shrieks before me, as he stumbled awkwardly along the level places and scrambled madly down the rickety ladders. And frightened as I was, I yet retained enough of perception to note that his speech, when articulate, was not of any sort known to me. Harsh but impressive polysyllables had replaced the customary mixture of bad Spanish and worse English. And of these, only the oft-repeated cry, Huitzilopochtli, seemed in the least familiar. Later, I definitely placed that word in the works of a great historian, and shuddered when the association came to me. Footnote. Prescott, Conquest of Mexico. End of footnote. The climax of that awful night was composite but fairly brief, beginning just as I reached the final cavern of the journey. Out of the darkness immediately ahead burst a final shriek from the Mexican, which was joined by such a chorus of uncouth sound as I could never hear again and survive. In that moment, it seemed as if all the hidden terrors and monstrosities of Earth had become articulate in an effort to overwhelm the human race. Simultaneously, the light from my ring was extinguished, and I saw a new light glimmering from lower space but a few yards ahead of me. I had arrived at the abyss, which was now redly aglow, and which had evidently swallowed up the unfortunate Romero. Advancing, I peered over the edge of that chasm which no line could fathom, and which was now a pandemonium of flickering flame and hideous uproar. At first, I beheld nothing but a seething blur of luminosity. But then shapes, all infinitely distant, began to detach themselves from the confusion. And I saw... Was it Juan Romero? But God! I dare not tell you what I saw. Some power from heaven, coming to my aid, obliterated both sights and sounds in such a crash as may be heard when two universes collide in space. Chaos supervened, and I knew the peace of oblivion. I hardly know how to continue, since conditions so singular are involved, but I will do my best, not even trying to differentiate betwixt the real and the apparent. When I awaked, I was safe in my bunk, and the red glow of dawn was visible at the window. Some distance away, the lifeless body of Juan Romero lay upon a table, surrounded by a group of men, including the camp doctor. The men were discussing the strange death of the Mexican as he lay asleep, a death seemingly connected in some way with the terrible bolt of lightning which had struck and shaken the mountain. No direct cause was evident, and an autopsy failed to show any reason why Romero should not be living. Snatches of conversation indicated beyond a doubt that neither Romero nor I had left the bunkhouse during the night, that neither had been awake during the frightful storm which had passed over the Cactus Range. That storm, said men who had ventured down the mine shaft, had caused extensive caving in, and had completely closed the deep abyss which had created so much apprehension the day before. When I asked the watchman what sounds he had heard prior to the mighty thunderbolt, he mentioned a coyote, a dog, and the snarling mountain wind. Nothing more. Nor do I doubt his word. Upon the resumption of work, Superintendent Arthur called on some especially dependable men to make a few investigations around the spot where the gulf had appeared. Though hardly eager, they obeyed, and a deep boring was made. Results were very curious. The roof of the void, as seen whilst it was open, was not by any means thick. Yet now the drills of the investigators met what appeared to be a limitless extent of solid rock. Finding nothing else, not even gold, the superintendent abandoned his attempts. But a perplexed look occasionally steals over his countenance as he sits thinking at his desk. One other thing is curious. Shortly after waking on that morning after the storm, I noticed the unaccountable absence of my Hindu ring from my finger. I had prized it greatly, yet nevertheless felt a sensation of relief at its disappearance. If one of my fellow miners appropriated it, he must have been quite clever in disposing of his booty, for despite advertisements and a police search, the ring was never seen again. Somehow I doubt if it was stolen by mortal hands, for many strange things were taught me in India. My opinion of my whole experience varies from time to time. In broad daylight, and at most seasons, I am apt to think the greater part of it a mere dream. But sometimes in the autumn, about 2 in the morning, when winds and animals howl dismally, there comes from inconceivable depths below a damnable suggestion of rhythmical throbbing. And I feel that the transition of Juan Romero was a terrible one indeed. The street. There be those who say that things and places have souls, and there be those who say they have not. I dare not say myself, but I will tell of the street. Men of strength and honor fashioned that street, good, valiant men of our blood, who had come from the blessed isles across the sea. At first, it was but a path trodden by bearers of water from the woodland spring to the cluster of houses by the beach. Then, as more men came to the growing cluster of houses and looked about for places to dwell, they built cabins along the north side, cabins of stout oaken logs with masonry on the side toward the forest, for many Indians lurked there with fire arrows. And in a few years more, men built cabins on the south side of the street. Up and down the street walked grave men in conical hats, who most of the time carried muskets or fowling pieces. And there were also their bonneted wives and sober children. In the evening, these men with their wives and children would sit about gigantic hearths and read and speak. Very simple were the things of which they read and spoke, yet things which gave them courage and goodness, and helped them by day to subdue the forest and till the field. And the children would listen, and learn of the laws and deeds of old, and of that dear England which they had never seen or could not remember. There was war, and thereafter no more Indians troubled the street. The men, busy with labor, waxed prosperous and as happy as they knew how to be. And the children grew up comfortably, and more families came from the motherland to dwell on the street. And the children's children and the newcomers' children grew up. The town was now a city, and one by one the cabins gave place to houses, simple, beautiful houses of brick and wood, with stone steps and iron railings and fanlights over the doors. No flimsy creations were these houses, for they were made to serve many a generation. Within, there were carven mantels and graceful stairs, and sensible, pleasing furniture, china and silver, brought from the motherland. So the street drank in the dreams of a young people, and rejoiced as its dwellers became more graceful and happy. Where once had been only strength and honor, taste and learning now abode as well. Books and paintings and music came to the houses. And the young men went to the university, which rose above the plain to the north. In the place of conical hats and muskets, there were three-cornered hats and small swords, and lace and snowy periwigs. And there were cobblestones over which clattered many a blooded horse and rumbled many a gilded coach, and brick sidewalks with horse blocks and hitching posts. There were in that street many trees, elms and oaks and maples of dignity, so that in the summer, the scene was all soft verdure and twittering bird song. And behind the houses were walled rose gardens, with hedged paths and sundials, where at evening the moon and stars would shine bewitchingly, while fragrant blossoms glistened with dew. So the street dreamed on, past wars, calamities, and changes. Once, most of the young men went away, and some never came back. That was when they furled the old flag and put up a new banner of stripes and stars. But though men talked of great changes, the street felt them not, for its folk were still the same, speaking of the old familiar things in the old familiar accents. And the trees still sheltered singing birds, and at evening the moon and stars looked down upon dewy blossoms in the walled rose gardens. In time, there were no more swords, three-cornered hats, or periwigs in the street. How strange seemed the denizens with their walking sticks, tall beavers, and cropped heads. New sounds came from the distance. First, strange puffings and shrieks from the river a mile away. And then, many years later, strange puffings and shrieks and rumblings from other directions. The air was not quite so pure as before, but the spirit of the place had not changed. The blood and soul of the people were as the blood and soul of their ancestors who had fashioned the street. Nor did the spirit change when they tore open the earth to lay down strange pipes, or when they set up tall posts bearing weird wires. There was so much ancient lore in that street that the past could not easily be forgotten. Then came days of evil, when many who had known the street of old knew it no more, and many knew it who had not known it before, and those who came were never as those who went away, for their accents were coarse and strident, and their mien and faces unpleasing. Their thoughts, too, fought with the wise, just spirit of the street, so that the street pined silently as its houses fell into decay, and its trees died one by one, and its rose gardens grew rank with weeds and waste. But it felt a stir of pride one day, when again marched forth young men, some of whom never came back. These young men were clad in blue. With the years, worse fortune came to the street. Its trees were all gone now, and its rose gardens were displaced by the backs of cheap, ugly new buildings on parallel streets. Yet the houses remained, despite the ravages of the years and the storms and worms, for they had been made to serve many a generation. New kinds of faces appeared in the street, swarthy, sinister faces with furtive eyes and odd features, whose owners spoke unfamiliar words and placed signs in known and unknown characters upon most of the musty houses. Push carts crowded the gutters. A sordid, undefinable stench settled over the place, and the ancient spirit slept. Great excitement once came to the street. War and revolution were raging across the seas. A dynasty had collapsed, and its degenerate subjects were flocking with dubious intent to the western land. Many of these took lodgings in the battered houses that had once known the songs of birds and the scent of roses. Then the western land itself awoke and joined the motherland in her titanic struggle for civilization. Over the cities once more floated the old flag, companioned by the new flag and by a plainer yet glorious tricolor. But not many flags floated over the street, for therein brooded only fear and hatred and ignorance. Again, young men went forth, but not quite as did the young men of those other days. Something was lacking, and the sons of those young men of other days, who did indeed go forth in olive drab with the true spirit of their ancestors, went from distant places and knew not the street and its ancient spirit. Over the seas there was a great victory, and in triumph most of the young men returned. Those who had lacked something lacked it no longer, yet did fear and hatred and ignorance still brood over the street. For many had stayed behind, and many strangers had come from distant places to the ancient houses. And the young men who had returned dwelt there no longer. Swarthy and sinister were most of the strangers, yet among them one might find a few faces like those who fashioned the street and molded its spirit. Like and yet unlike, for there was in the eyes of all a weird, unhealthy glitter as of greed, ambition, vindictiveness, or misguided zeal. Unrest and treason were abroad amongst an evil few who plotted to strike the western land its death blow, that they might mount to power over its ruins, even as assassins had mounted in that unhappy frozen land from whence most of them had come. And the heart of that plotting was in the street, whose crumbling houses teemed with alien makers of discord and echoed with the plans and speeches of those who yearned for the appointed day of blood, flame, and crime. Of the various odd assemblages in the street, the law said much but could prove little. With great diligence did men of hidden badges linger and listen about such places as Petrovich's Bakery, the squalid Rifkin School of Modern Economics, the Circle Social Club, and the Liberty Café. There congregated sinister men in great numbers, yet always was their speech guarded or in a foreign tongue. And still the old houses stood, with their forgotten lore of nobler departed centuries, of sturdy colonial tenants and dewy rose gardens in the moonlight. Sometimes a lone poet or traveler would come to view them, and would try to picture them in their vanished glory. Yet of such travelers and poets, there were not many. The rumor now spread widely that these houses contained the leaders of a vast band of terrorists, who, on a designated day, were to launch an orgy of slaughter for the extermination of America and of all the fine old traditions which the street had loved. Handbills and papers fluttered about filthy gutters. Handbills and papers printed in many tongues and in many characters, yet all bearing messages of crime and rebellion. In these writings, the people were urged to tear down the laws and virtues that our fathers had exalted, to stamp out the soul of the old America, the soul that was bequeathed through 1,500 years of Anglo-Saxon freedom, justice, and moderation. It was said that the swart men who dwelt in the street and congregated in its rotting edifices were the brains of a hideous revolution, that at their word of command, many millions of brainless, besotted beasts would stretch forth their noisome talons from the slums of 1,000 cities, burning, slaying, and destroying, till the land of our fathers should be no more. All this was said and repeated, and many looked forward in dread to the 4th day of July, about which the strange writings hinted much. Yet could nothing be found to place the guilt. None could tell just whose arrest might cut off the damnable plotting at its source. Many times came bands of blue-coated police to search the shaky houses, though at last they ceased to come, for they too had grown tired of law and order, and had abandoned all the city to its fate. Then men in olive drab came, bearing muskets, till it seemed as if in its sad sleep the street must have some haunting dreams of those other days, when musket-bearing men in conical hats walked along it from the woodland spring to the cluster of houses by the beach. Yet could no act be performed to check the impending cataclysm, for the swart, sinister men were old in cunning. So the street slept uneasily on, till one night there gathered in Petrovich's bakery and the Rifkin School of Modern Economics and the Circle Social Club and Liberty Cafe and in other places as well, vast hordes of men whose eyes were big with horrible triumph and expectation. Over hidden wires, strange messages traveled, and much was said of still stranger messages yet to travel. But most of this was not guessed till afterward, when the western land was safe from the peril. The men in olive drab could not tell what was happening, or what they ought to do, for the swart, sinister men were skilled in subtlety and concealment. And yet the men in olive drab will always remember that night, and will speak of the street as they tell of it to their grandchildren. For many of them were sent there toward morning on a mission unlike that which they had expected. It was known that this nest of anarchy was old, and that the houses were tottering from the ravages of the years and the storms and the worms. Yet was the happening of that summer night a surprise, because of its very queer uniformity. It was indeed an exceedingly singular happening, though after all a simple one. For without warning, in one of the small hours beyond midnight, all the ravages of the years and the storms and the worms came to a tremendous climax. And after the crash, there was nothing left standing in the street save 2 ancient chimneys and part of a stout brick wall. Nor did anything that had been alive come alive from the ruins. A poet and a traveler, who came with the mighty crowd that sought the scene, tell odd stories. The poet says that all through the hours before dawn, he beheld sordid ruins, but indistinctly in the glare of the arc lights, that there loomed above the wreckage another picture wherein he could descry moonlight and fair houses and elms and oaks and maples of dignity. And the traveler declares that instead of the place's wonted stench, there lingered a delicate fragrance, as of roses in full bloom. But are not the dreams of poets and the tales of travelers notoriously false? There be those who say that things and places have souls, and there be those who say they have not. I dare not say myself, but I have told you of the street. Poetry and the Gods, footnote, with Anna Helen Crofts, and a footnote. A damp, gloomy evening in April it was, just after the close of the Great War, when Marcia found herself alone with strange thoughts and wishes, unheard-of yearnings which floated out of the spacious 20th-century drawing-room, up the misty deeps of the air, and eastward to far olive groves in Arcady, which she had seen only in her dreams. She had entered the room in abstraction, turned off the glaring chandeliers, and now reclined on a soft divan by a solitary lamp, which shed over the reading-table a green glow as soothing and delicious as moonlight through the foliage about an antique shrine. Attired simply in a low-cut evening dress of black, she appeared outwardly a typical product of modern civilization. But tonight she felt the immeasurable gulf that separated her soul from all her prosaic surroundings. Was it because of the strange home in which she lived, that abode of coldness where relations were always strained and the inmates scarcely more than strangers? Was it that? Or was it some greater and less explicable misplacement in time and space, whereby she had been born too late, too early, or too far away from the haunts of her spirit, ever to harmonize with the unbeautiful things of contemporary reality? To dispel the mood which was engulfing her more deeply each moment, she took a magazine from the table and searched for some healing bit of poetry. Poetry had always relieved her troubled mind better than anything else, though many things in the poetry she had seen detracted from the influence. Over parts of even the sublimest verses hung a chill vapor of sterile ugliness and restraint, like dust on a window pane through which one views a magnificent sunset. Listlessly turning the magazine's pages, as if searching for an elusive treasure, she suddenly came upon something which dispelled her languor. An observer could have read her thoughts and told that she had discovered some image or dream which brought her nearer to her unattained goal than any image or dream she had seen before. It was only a bit of vers libre, that pitiful compromise of the poet who overleaps prose yet falls short of the divine melody of numbers, but it had in it all the unstudied music of a bard who lives and feels and who gropes ecstatically for unveiled beauty. Devoid of regularity, it yet had the wild harmony of winged, spontaneous words, a harmony missing from the formal, convention-bound verse she had known. As she read on, her surroundings gradually faded, and soon there lay about her only the mists of dream, the purple, star-strewn mists beyond time, where only gods and dreamers walk. Moon over Japan, white butterfly moon, where the heavy-lidded Buddhas dream to the sound of the cuckoo's call. The white wings of moon butterflies flicker down the streets of the city, blushing into silence the useless wicks of round lanterns in the hands of girls. Moon over the tropics, a white curved bud opening its petals slowly in the warmth of heaven. The air is full of odors and languorous warm sounds. A flute drones its insect music to the night below the curving moon petal of the heavens. Moon over China, weary moon on the river of the sky, the stir of light in the willows is like the flashing of a thousand silver minnows through dark shoals. The tiles on graves and rotting temples flash like ripples. The sky is flecked with clouds like the scales of a dragon. Amid the mists of dream, the reader cried to the rhythmical stars of her delight at the coming of a new age of song, a rebirth of Pan. Half closing her eyes, she repeated words whose melody lay hid like crystals at the bottom of a stream before the dawn, hidden but to gleam effulgently at the birth of day.
Moon over Japan, white butterfly moon. Moon over the tropics, a white curved bud opening its petals slowly in the warmth of heaven. The air is full of odors and languorous warm sounds. Languorous warm sounds. Moon over China. Weary moon on the river of the sky. Weary moon. Out of the mists gleamed godlike the form of a youth in winged helmet and sandals, caduceus bearing, and of a beauty like to nothing on earth. Before the face of the sleeper, he thrice waved the rod which Apollo had given him in trade for the nine-corded shell of melody, and upon her brow he placed a wreath of myrtle and roses. Then, adoring, Hermes spoke, O nymph, more fair than the golden-haired sisters of Cyane, or the sky-inhabiting Atlantides, beloved of Aphrodite and blessed of Pallas, thou hast indeed discovered the secret of the gods, which lieth in beauty and song. O prophetess, more lovely than the Sibyl of Cumae, when Apollo first knew her, thou hast truly spoken of the new age. For even now, on Menelaus, Pan sighs and stretches in his sleep, wishful to awake and behold about him the little rose-crowned fauns and the antique satyrs. In thy yearning hast thou divined what no mortal else, saving only a few whom the world rejects, remembereth, that the gods were never dead, but only sleeping the sleep and dreaming the dreams of gods in lotus-filled Hesperian gardens beyond the golden sunset. And now draweth nigh the time of their awaking, when coldness and ugliness shall perish, and Zeus sit once more on Olympus. Already the sea about Paphos trembleth into a foam which only ancient skies have looked on before, and at night on Helicon the shepherds hear strange murmurings and half-remembered notes. Woods and fields are tremulous at twilight with the shimmering of white saltant forms, and immemorial ocean yields up curious sights beneath thin moons. The gods are patient and have slept long, but neither man nor giant shall defy the gods forever. In Tartarus the Titans writhe, and beneath the fiery Etna groan the children of Uranus and Gea. The day now dawns when man must answer for centuries of denial. But in sleeping the gods have grown kind, and will not hurl him to the gulf made for deniers of gods. Instead will their vengeance smite the darkness, fallacy, and ugliness which have turned the mind of man. And under the sway of bearded Saturnus shall mortals, once more sacrificing unto him, dwell in beauty and delight. This night shalt thou know the favor of the gods, and behold on Parnassus those dreams which the gods have through ages sent to earth to show that they are not dead. For poets are the dreams of the gods, and in each age someone hath sung unknowing the message and the promise from the lotus gardens beyond the sunset. Then in his arms Hermes bore the dreaming maiden through the skies. Gentle breezes from the tower of Iolos wafted them high above warm-scented seas, till suddenly they came upon Zeus holding court on the double-headed Parnassus, his golden throne flanked by Apollo and the Muses on the right hand, and by ivy-wreathed Dionysus and pleasure-flushed Bacchae on the left hand. So much of splendor Marcia had never seen before, either awake or in dreams. But its radiance did her no injury, as would have the radiance of lofty Olympus. For in this lesser court the father of gods had tempered his glories for the sight of mortals. Before the laurel-draped mouth of the Corycian cave sat in a row six noble forms with the aspect of mortals, but the countenances of gods. These the dreamer recognized from images of them which she had beheld, and she knew that they were none else than the divine Maeonides,
the Avernian Dante, the more-than-mortal Shakespeare, the chaos-exploring Milton, the cosmic Goethe, and the Musean Keats. These were those messengers whom the gods had sent to tell men that Pan had passed not away, but only slept. For it is in poetry that gods speak to men. Then spake the Thunderer, O daughter, for being one of my endless line, thou art indeed my daughter. Behold, upon ivory thrones of honor, the august messengers that gods have sent down, that in the words and writings of men there may be still some trace of divine beauty. Other bards have men justly crowned with enduring laurels, but these hath Apollo crowned, and these have I set in places apart, as mortals who have spoken the language of the gods. Long have we dreamed in lotus gardens beyond the west, and spoken only through our dreams. But the time approaches when our voices shall not be silent. It is a time of awaking and of change. Once more hath Phaeton ridden low, searing the fields and drying the streams. In Gaul, lone nymphs with disordered hair weep beside fountains that are no more, and pine over rivers turned red with the blood of mortals. Ares and his train have gone forth with the madness of gods, and have returned. Deimos and Phobos glutted with unnatural delight. Tellus moans with grief, and the faces of men are as the faces of the Erinyes, even as when Astrea fled to the skies, and the waves of our bidding encompassed all the land, saving this high peak alone. Amidst this chaos, prepared to herald his coming, yet to conceal his arrival, even now toileth our latest-born messenger, in whose dreams are all the images which other messengers have dreamed before him. He it is that we have chosen to blend into one glorious whole all the beauty that the world hath known before, and to write words wherein shall echo all the wisdom and the loveliness of the past. He it is who shall proclaim our return, and sing of the days to come, when fauns and dryads shall haunt their accustomed groves in beauty. Guided was our choice by those who now sit before the Corician grotto on thrones of ivory, and in whose songs thou shalt hear notes of sublimity, by which years hence thou shalt know the greater messenger when he cometh. Attend their voices, as one by one they sing to thee here. Each note shall thou hear again in the poetry which is to come, the poetry which shalt bring peace and pleasure to thy soul, though search for it through bleak years thou must. Attend with diligence, for each chord that vibrates away into hiding shall appear again to thee after thou hast returned to earth, as Alpheus, sinking his waters into the soul of Hellas, appears as the crystal Arethusa in remote Sicilia. Then arose Homeros, the ancient among bards, who took his lyre and chaunted his hymn to Aphrodite. No word of Greek did Marcia know, yet did the message not fall vainly upon her ears, for in the cryptic rhythm was that which spake to all mortals and gods, and needed no interpreter. So too the songs of Dante and Goethe, whose unknown words clave the ether with melodies easy to read and to adore. But at last, remembered accents resounded before the listener. It was the swan of Avon, once a god among men, and still a god among gods. Write, write, that from the bloody course of war, my dearest master, your dear son may hie. Bless him at home in peace, whilst I from far his name with zealous fervor sanctify. Accents still more familiar arose as Milton, blind no more, declaimed immortal harmony. For let thy lamp at midnight hour be seen in some high lonely tower, where I might oft outwatch the bear with thrice great Hermes, or unsphere the spirit of Plato, to unfold what worlds or what vast regions hold the immortal mind that hath forsook her mansion in this fleshly nook. Sometime that gorgeous tragedy in sceptered pall comes sweeping by, presenting Thebes or Pelops' line, or the tale of Troy divine. Last of all came the young voice of Keats, closest of all the messengers to the beauteous fawn folk. Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter. Therefore, ye soft pipes, play on. When old age shall this generation waste, thou shalt remain, in midst of other woe than ours, a friend to man, to whom thou sayest, beauty is truth, truth, beauty. That is all ye know on earth, and all ye need to know. As the singer ceased, there came a sound in the wind blowing from far Egypt, where at night Aurora mourns by the Nile for her slain son Memnon. To the feet of the thunderer flew the rosy-fingered goddess, and kneeling cried, Master, it is time I unlocked the gates of the east. And Phoebus, handing his lyre to Calliope, his bride among the Muses, prepared to depart for the jeweled and column-raised palace of the sun, where fretted the steeds already harnessed to the golden car of day. So Zeus descended from his carven throne and placed his hand upon the head of Marcia, saying, Daughter, the dawn is nigh, and it is well that thou shouldst return before the awaking of mortals to thy home. Weep not at the bleakness of thy life, for the shadow of false faiths will soon be gone, and the gods shall once more walk among men. Search thou unceasingly for our messenger, for in him wilt thou find peace and comfort. By his word shall thy steps be guided to happiness, and in his dreams of beauty shall thy spirit find all that it craveth. As Zeus ceased, the young Hermes gently seized the maiden and bore her up toward the fading stars, up and westward over unseen seas. Many years have passed since Marcia dreamt of the gods and of their Parnassian conclave. Tonight she sits in the same spacious drawing-room, but she is not alone. Gone is the old spirit of unrest, for beside her is one whose name is luminous with celebrity, the young poet of poets at whose feet sits all the world. He is reading from a manuscript words which none has ever heard before, but which, when heard, will bring to men the dreams and fancies they lost so many centuries ago, when Pan lay down to doze in Arcady, and the greater gods withdrew to sleep in lotus gardens beyond the lands of the Hesperides. In the subtle cadences and hidden melodies of the bard, the spirit of the maiden has found rest at last. For there echo the divinest notes of Thracian Orpheus, notes that moved the very rocks and trees by Hebrus' banks. The singer ceases, and with eagerness asks a verdict. Yet what can Marcia say but that the strain is fit for the gods? And as she speaks, there comes again a vision of Parnassus, and the far-off sound of a mighty voice, saying, By his word shall thy steps be guided to happiness, and in his dreams of beauty shall thy spirit find all that it craveth.